And I think Dad covered for him a lot. I don't know that Dad would give you this opinion, but I'm sure that this is right. Mrs. Hunter was really quite a socialite. And they used to have bridge parties, you know, and they were very careful that this man's wife was invited to this. Very much like the Army, I think, is today. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, and Daddy was very well liked among the Navajos. From the earliest time I can remember, he was a friend of the Navajo. And Mr. Hunter knew this. And I think Mr. Hunter leaned on Daddy to be his liaison between the Navajo and the government service. And Mr. Hunter wasn't a strong enough willed person to stand up only for the Navajo, like Dad did. So I think that that's where they...
Didn't he have a slightly different responsibility, though, whereas your father's job was more clear to represent the interests of
the
Navajo?
Right, right. And Mr. Hunter had to balance out everything.
Right.
The agency and the whole... He was a very fine man, and he and Daddy are very good friends. And, I mean, were very good friends. Always.
You don't happen to remember the succession of superintendents, do you?
Golly, I don't. I can remember Trotter. I can remember Fryer.
Fryer.
Mm-hmm. He was a red-headed man, I believe.
Yeah. Your father, I think, has already spoken to the point about him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. After Mr. Hunter, Daddy and the superintendents were never buddies. I mean, they seemed to sort of break apart at that point. Turn off and I'll shut these doors. At Window Rock. It seemed to dissolve into more bureaucracy than it had been before, from my point of view. Now, I don't know whether it actually happened that way.
Did you ever actually sit down and talk with somebody like Hunter or someone of those men who were tied to the offices there in Fort Defiance or Window Rock? Did you ever hear the other side of the picture?
No, I didn't. I only heard my family side of it, and I'm sure that my opinion was colored by Dad. Because I know that Daddy suffered great frustration at not being able to do what he felt was practical. Now, I think Daddy is a very practical person, and I think that being among the Navajos and loving them the way he did, you know, the Navajos are very practical people. If you can do it an easy, straightforward way, then that's the way to do it. And I think Dad felt that the Bureau of Indian Affairs was so seeped in
bureaucracy,
things that were not real necessary. And I think that, of course, was his
big
hang-up.
We can't come to any conclusions about this, but I think that I'm sure you're aware that when there is a difference in viewpoints, there are usually two sides.
Now wait a minute. I can give you a little bit. Now you said that I ever talked. No, I didn't actually talk to him because I was too young. I mean, I listened.
Well, I mean,
a lot.
Even after the war.
The Indian trader and the range riders. Now, the range riders were very good friends of Daddy's. As a matter of fact, I think Daddy must have had some authority over the range riders because they used to report into our house quite often from all different parts of the reservation. Of course, that would be because Dad was involved with the livestock, and so were the range riders.
But your father was out in the field a great deal, too.
Yeah, he was. Daddy always had to travel with Chi Dodge. Chi Dodge wouldn't go anyplace unless Daddy go with him. Now I remember this quite clearly because I went with him a few times. Whenever the officials from Washington would come and they'd want to take a trip through the reservation and they would want Chi Dodge to go with them, Chi Dodge would not go unless Daddy would go with him. Now there was a point of antagonism with the superintendents because the superintendents felt that Daddy was not on their, not social level exactly, but job level. And I think they resented the fact that she insisted that Daddy go with them every time. But she trusted Daddy, and they always stayed together in the same hotel rooms. And, I mean, they just were buddies, I guess.
Well, what I think you're saying is that the bureaucrat, whether he was in Washington or came out from Washington, or whether he was in Fort Defiance or Window Rock, who shuffled papers and who had to coordinate the process of administering the reservation, mm-hmm. found it very difficult to trust somebody like your father, who was so close to the Navajo and so sympathetic with their point of view.
Why would that be, though? I've never been able to understand that. Why didn't they capitalize on his good feeling among the Navajo?
Well, of course, I couldn't possibly give you an answer to that, and yet I can tell you that from the experience that I've had working with the people that administered the Taylor Grazing Act, which was very germane
yeah.
to your particular situation
yeah.
there on the reservation, this problem existed all over the place because Washington could not understand how the cattlemen and sheepmen could administer a government program. And yet this is precisely the way it was organized. It was supposed to be organized at the grassroots, and it was organized by people who knew the land and the people, which is the comparison
mm-hmm.
we're making here.
Mm-hmm.
And since Washington didn't know how to ride a horse, and people from Washington didn't know how to live on the land, there is a natural cultural
mm-hmm.
gap here between the two groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
And with this comes the mistrust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'd agree with me, a certain amount of jealousy.
Yes, I felt jealousy from the time I was a little girl. I felt jealousy in the schools when I was in grade school, very much so, because I don't know why, but I always had friends among the Navajos. And we had the government service employees' children went to the public school. And they had a big boarding school there at Fort Defiance. Now, a very good friend of mine, his grandfather, was not a Navajo. He was Oklahoma Indian, and he was head of the boys' building, they used to call it, where the boys all lived. And another good friend of mine was head of the kitchen. She was a dear old friend of the family, Mrs. Clara B. Lee. And there's quite a story in that. Her father-in-law was the B. Lee that was for the Mountain Meadow Massacre.
Oh,
you know?
John D. Lee.
John D. Lee, yeah. That time. Anyhow, I spent a lot of time at the boys' building with the Navajo boys. And
you can strike that later.
No kidding. We wore coveralls, you know, the blue coveralls, and oh my. Then they had the Good Shepherd Mission there at Fort Defiance, and this is where the orphan children lived that were brought in from the reservation. This is Episcopal Mission. Now, the orphan children went to the public schools, and these were my friends. Now, I don't know where the government service children were. They were there. We weren't the only white children in school.
But it is interesting that with essentially a small number of
yeah.
white people in an Indian environment, that there was so much social consciousness.
It was terrible.
Among government officials.
Oh, very much so. I started to tell you when we moved to Crown Point. Mother had moved to Albuquerque. We were moving to Crown Point. Before we moved to Crown Point, the word was over at Crown Point that Tom Allen was moving to Crown Point as superintendent. At that time, the principal of the school was living in the superintendent's house. And I don't know whether he was told to move or what the situation was, but when Mother and Daddy went over, he told Dad that he would move out of the house and let him have it. And Daddy said, well, that's ridiculous. He said, there's just going to be Robbie and I here. We'll live down here at this house on the corner. And there were some people in Crown Point that never did quite get over that. They just couldn't imagine why Daddy didn't move in to Crown Point and make the superintendent of the schools, who was in the wrong house, move out so that we could have the big house at Crown Point.
Well, now, since we're on your dad, can you go back now and give a thumbnail sketch of what you know, not necessarily what you remember, but what you know about how he got into this New Mexico country and eventually up onto the Indian reservation. And the more specific dates that you have that you think are right, the better, because we'll cross-check them with,
okay,
with documents and with what other people say.
Okay, I've got notes all over it. Okay, the first time Daddy came to Albuquerque, he lived in Texaco, New Mexico, with his mother and father. And hit my grandfather Alan had a water wagon in Texaco. He hauled water for the city, for the town of Texaco, New Mexico, which is right on the Texas New Mexico border.
Yeah. Now, when was this?
Well, it must have been before 1904, because in 1904, Daddy brought two racehorses to Albuquerque to the state fair, and he brought them on the railroad. He shipped them in, these racehorses, and they stayed at the McCombs Hotel. That would be interesting to check out.
Yeah.
Oh, it was supposed to be very lovely at that time. So that was in 1904, so Daddy was about 15 years old at that time. He and a cousin, I'm not clear which one, brought those horses to Albuquerque. That was the first time he'd ever been actually in Albuquerque or this far.
Well, now, had he come out to visit his father?
No, he lived in Texaco, New Mexico, and with Grandma and Grandpa.
Was he born there?
No, Daddy was born in Oklahoma, in the Oklahoma Territory. I can't tell you where. My grandmother and grandfather Alan homesteaded in the Oklahoma Territory. And then I think they had a small herd of cattle. And I think they kept drowsing out, as Dad calls it. I think they kept losing them, you know, with the droughts and so forth.
That would make your grandfather homesteaded in the Oklahoma Territory. Do you happen to know whether he was a Sooner?
A what?
A Sooner, S-O-O-N-E-R, one of those who lined up in the 1890s and went rushing across when the signal was given?
I don't, but that would be interesting to find out. Daddy would know.
Well, we'll find that out, because that would certainly be a nice beginning to this whole thing.
Yeah.
If we could start there, it would be a historical point that everybody would know.
Yeah.
But it sounds as if they might have been.
It's very possible.
Where did they come from, you know?
Well, I haven't traced our genealogy back as far as I'd like to, but they came from Kentucky, originally, and they fought on the side of the South in the Civil War. And how they came into Oklahoma and then later into Texas, I don't know. Now, I have an idea that Grandpa, living in Texaco, was only a job at the time, because I think their roots were in Texas, in Spur, Texas. Because Grandpa Alan and my grandfather Day knew each other for many years before, as I understand. And my grandfather Day, which is mother's father, was a rancher in Spur, Texas. So then Daddy's family moved to Spur, Texas from Texaco in 1909, and at that time they worked on the Circle S Ranch, which was the Spur Ranch. It must have been a very big outfit at the time. Grandpa worked there and Daddy did too. They both worked on the Spur Ranch.
Where did you get this?
From Dad and from Mother. Long years ago, Mother and I wrote a lot of this down.
When did he start at the Circle S?
1909. And then he and Mama were married in 1913. In April of 1913.
Where was the headquarters of the Circle S?
Spur, Texas.
It was right in this town, or was it?
No, it must have been out from the town. Now, you know, that must have been quite a a relationship there, because Mother and Daddy's wedding was at the Spur Ranch, at the Spur Ranch headquarters.